This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
The Hyatt Regency walkway collapse is probably one of the most notorious architectural failures in U.S. history, to the point where aspiring architects will study it so they know what not to do. When this happened at the Hyatt Regency Kansas City Hotel in Kansas City, Missouri in 1981, it was the deadliest structural collapse up until the tragic events of the World Trade Center 20 years later. So what went so wrong? Well, it was one simple overlooked design flaw that cost so many people their lives. So, hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Prism of the Past. And today we're obviously going to be discussing the Hyatt Regency walkway collapse. As an aside, there will be a content warning because later on, as during the collapse sequence when we discuss what happened, things will get a bit gruesome, so just a heads up. But before we do get into the collapse itself, let's briefly discuss Hyatt's history to provide a bit of context as to who they are. Their history as a corporation begins in the late 19th century, really, when Pritzker family immigrated to the United States from the Ukraine. Patriarch Nicholas Pritzker led the family to Chicago and founded Pritzker & Pritzker P&P, the law firm that later evolved into a management company. By the late 20s, P&P's best clients were the Goldblatt brothers, a low-priced Chicago department store chain. Through the Goldblatts, the Pritzkers connected with Walter M. Heyman, a leading Chicago commercial banker, and the two became business associates. The story of Hyatt Corporation begins with the succeeding generation of Pritzkers. By the early 1950s, Pritzker's oldest son, Jay, had become active in the family business. Something of a prodigy, Jay Pritzker had graduated high school at 14. He finished college thereafter and then took a law degree from Northwestern University. During World War II, he worked first as a flight instructor and later for the U.S. government agency that managed German-owned companies. In that position, he sat on corporate boards with men many years his senior. An accomplished deal-breaker even in his earliest years, Jay would become later well-known for his quickness at sizing up balance sheets and offering deals. Jay, beginning in 1957, made the initial deals that formed the basis for Hyatt. The Pritzkers were moving up in the world, and that's for sure. Jay bought a small Los Angeles International Airport motel named Hyatt House in 1957, and within only 4 years, he expanded the property into a chain of 6 hotels. His younger brother, Donald, became the manager of operations. It's said that they made a good team, and within the first decade, the company expanded massively. The company went public in 1967, and that same year, they opened its first hotel with the Atrium Tower lobby in Atlanta, designed by the architect John Portman. The Portman Atrium was a 21-story interior courtyard designed so that each hotel room entered off a high-rise open space set off with a central glass elevator leading to all floors, and hanging green vines growing from each floor's balcony. The overall effect was revolutionary because the Portman interior eliminated the impersonal hallway with rows of doors and brought to the hotel interior an open-air congeniality. With the spin-off of greater safety, feeling of security, and warmth, the Portman lobby became the hotel's signature and brought Hyatt to widespread notice for the first time, as well as advancing the concept of public space in buildings. There's many articles dedicated to the Portman lobby alone and how Portman has grown to be considered one of America's most influential architects because of it. Other sources critique Portman and his work, saying that his lobbies were more like casinos, hermetically sealed environments that substituted architectural flash for authentic urban vitality. In 1982, columnist for the Washington Post spoke of the difficulty navigating these spaces and wrote, "Indications of decadence are rife, but nowhere more so than in modern hotel lobbies. In such lobbies, it is possible to suffer vertigo as a result of the architecture and decor. Atlanta's Peachtree Plaza has a lobby that Lewis and Clark could not have found their way across." But whether you love or hate Portman's work, there is no denying its impact. What became the Hyatt Regency Atlanta was part of the 15-building Peachtree Center. Both Hilton and Marriott passed up on opportunities to purchase this property, but Hyatt bought it, finished the construction, and the occupancy rate reached 94.6%. They became a chain of 13 hotels by 1969, expanded internationally with Hyatt Regency Hong Kong, and again, all seemed untouchable. Of course, there were some troubling activities within the company. In the 70s, company president Hugh Skip Friend was found to have spent $300,000 worth on personal expenses. Seeing as Jay's brother Donald had passed away a few years earlier, Jay had to take on the duties of president, in addition to his responsibilities as chairman and CEO, and it was just too much on his plate. Even so, the company continued expanding, and of course, one of the projects that they took on was none other than the Hyatt Regency. As we learn about the context behind the Hyatt name, it's equally important to understand the context of which the Hyatt Regency in Kansas City, Missouri was built under. First and foremost, the Hyatt had been built in an era of high unemployment, inflation, and double-digit interest rates. There was a ton of pressure on builders to win contracts and complete projects quickly. In fact, this may have contributed to multiple collapses around this time, not just with the Hyatt. According to the Kansas City Star, notable structures around the country were falling at an alarming rate. The roof of a Hartford Civic Center arena collapsed in 1978. The following year, Kemper Arena's roof fell during an overnight rainstorm. Trade groups such as the American Society of Civil Engineers responded by launching investigations, stepping up peer reviews, and sponsoring seminars. They issued manuals aimed at shoring up professional standards and public confidence. Thankfully, no one was injured when the roof of the Civic Center collapsed, as it happened in the early morning when no one was in the building. Still, the fact that the center collapsed only 6 years after its construction began was obviously worrying and alarming. According to the official city investigation, the collapse didn't even occur because of heavy snowfall, but because the roof had begun failing the moment it had been installed. There were design errors, an underestimation of the weight of the roof, and differences between the design and actual built structure. As for the Kemper Arena roof in 1979, thankfully, no one was harmed there either, but it shocked architects throughout the states, according to Kansas City Magazine. On June 3, 1979, the Kemper Arena hosted a convention of America's top architects. The group gathered inside the West Bottom's sleek modernist arena, a structure recognized as one of the finest buildings in the nation. The next day, it simply had no roof. Helmut Jahn, a German-born architect, had been honored just hours before his masterpiece fell apart. This columnless design was revolutionary, with no big poles in the way for viewers to see the 1976 Republican National Convention. Yet, that same columnless design would be its downfall. The roof's weight couldn't be supported, and once a storm hit later that night, the roof collapsed to the floor. The arena's cool white exterior was largely intact, the New York Times later reported. But the interior was a mass of rubble, with the bright Missouri sun shining through a hole almost 200 feet square into the twisted remains of a scoreboard, ceiling trusses, and bright yellow insulation panels. Though in the Civic Center and the arena, no one was hurt, and that obviously wasn't the case for the Hyatt Hotel. You'd think that this simple mistake or design flaw would have led to architects, especially in the area, being a bit more cautious. But unfortunately, as we are about to unfold, that was not the case. Construction began in the spring of 1978, and already by December of 1979, when construction was still ongoing, part of the atrium roof collapsed. The inspection team was called in. However, their contract dealt with the cause of the collapse. They had no obligation to actually check any engineering or design work. And seriously, the issues here were rampant so early on. Another source explains how this all went down. During January and February 1979, the design of the hangar rod connections was changed in a series of events and disputed communications between the fabricator, Haven Steel Company, and the engineering design team, GCE International Incorporated. The fabricator changed the design from a one-rod to a two-rod system to simplify the assembly task, doubling the load on the connector, which ultimately resulted in the walkway's collapse. The fabricator, in sworn testimony before the administrative judicial hearings after the accident, claimed that his company telephoned the engineering firm for change approval. GCE denied ever receiving such a call from Havens. On October 14, 1979, more than 1 year before the walkway's collapse, while the hotel was still under construction, more than 2,700 square feet of the atrium roof collapsed because of one roof connections at the north end of the atrium failed. In testimony, GCE stated that on three separate occasions they requested on-site project representation during the construction phase. However, these requests were not acted on by the owner, Crown Center Redevelopment Corporation, due to the additional costs of providing on-site inspection. Even as originally designed, the walkways were barely capable of holding up the expected load and would have failed to meet the requirements of the Kansas City Building Code. The fact that the atrium roof collapsed even before construction was finished speaks volumes as to how doomed this project was. It seems rushed, though I'll be the first to admit that I am not a professional with how long a project of this size actually takes. Still, to have it done in 2 years, even with a roof collapse in between, does seem a bit fast. And again, I'm not saying that this caused the events of 1981 by any means, simply that it probably did not help. When I decided to do a quick search to see how long it takes to build a hotel between 2010 and 2019, the average length of time was just over 3 years. So it kind of seems like in 1980, and considering a whole roof collapse occurred here, this job should have taken much longer than 2 years, right? Apparently not, though, as in July 1980, the Kansas City Hyatt Regency Hotel opened for business. And within just a year, tragedy struck. Before we continue on to talk about the collapse and what happened afterwards, including lives that were lost, this is where we're going to take a break to thank today's sponsors for allowing us to create today's episode. When we return from this sponsored break, I will let you know that things will be graphic after we talk about the collapse and exactly what happened that night and the individuals that were there or the individuals that perished. So this is your heads up.
When you're looking for a new set of glasses to frame your face, it should be easy, affordable, and accessible. And 5 years ago, Felix Gray realized that, and hence, they were born. Since that time, Felix Gray has been on a mission to create a better relationship with you and your glasses. It doesn't matter whether you're heading back to the office, back to school, or back to whatever, Felix Gray has you covered. And it's super easy to find the perfect frame for you, and it doesn't matter if you have non-prescription, prescription, readers, or maybe you're interested in blue light glasses. Felix Gray has it all for you. I currently have the Volta style in black, and I find that they sit really nice on my face, they're easy, and I almost forget they're there. So I'm definitely interested in checking out a few of their other pairs too. So if you want to see what Felix Gray can do for your eyes today, make sure you check them out now at felixgrayglasses.com/prism. Again, that's felixgrayglasses.com/prism. Free shipping, free returns, free exchanges, felixgrayglasses.com/prism. How did you choose which internet service provider to use? The sad thing is, most of us have very little choice because ISPs operate the monopolies in the regions they serve. They use this monopoly power to take advantage of customers. Data caps, streaming throttles, the list goes on. But worst of all, many ISPs log your internet activity that sell your data to other big tech companies or advertisers. To prevent ISPs from seeing my current internet activity, I protect all of my devices with ExpressVPN. And I love ExpressVPN because it's one of the best ways to hide your online activity. You just download the app, tap one button on your device, and you're protected. I like that I can use it on my PC, but also that it translates over to my iPad, to my iPhone, to my work phone. I can just use it everywhere. It's super easy, it syncs up, and it always is going to do its job. So stop handing over your personal data to ISPs and other tech giants who mine your activity and sell off your information. Get yourself protected by visiting expressvpn.com/prism. That's expressvpn.com/prism to get 3 extra months for free. Again, go to expressvpn.com/prism right now to learn more.
Two of those walkways collapsed.
I knew exactly what happened before anybody told me, because like I said, when I heard that metal and concrete go, I knew.
Emergency workers, doctors, and regular people searched the rubble. Men, women, and children trapped under tons of debris, some of them alive.
It was July 17th, 1981. It was a beautiful Friday evening, and in the atrium of the Hyatt Regency, the orchestra crooned jazz tunes from the hotel's popular tea dance. Nearly 2,000 people were in attendance, although some sources say 1,500. Many of them were dancing. About 150 people peered down from two 32-ton concrete walkways. One 2 stories up, the other 4 stories up, both of which were suspended by 1.5-inch thick steel rods. It started with the cement ripping from a wall before the fourth-floor walkway plunged and landed on the second-floor walkway. A split second later, and both walkways slammed into the hotel ground. For half a second, there was silence, Bridget Cleary, a 23-year-old nurse, later told Newsweek. She heard the tinkling of broken glass and a stream of water from broken pipes. A soft white dust filled the air. The music stopped, then everyone started screaming. Disembodied limbs sprouted from the wreckage, bodies lie in halves, necks snapped, some skin had already turned blue. It all looked like a human sandwich, arms and legs hanging out, said 27-year-old salesman Michael Loneshar. It was 7:05 p.m. Trapped victims tried to soothe each other. Survivors searched for missing loved ones, trying to pry boulders off bodies. It was truly a disturbing scene. The triage supervisor, Dr. Joseph Wakerl, would whistle for workers to be silent so he could locate cries for help. A triage center had to be set up in a hallway, and the parking structure served as a morgue. A priest picked through the victims, delivering the Catholic rite of anointing the sick. According to the Kansas City Star, which won a Pulitzer Prize for its Hyatt Regency disaster reporting, he asked one trapped man how he was doing. The man responded, "Well, my Timex is still going." After 9.5 hours, Mark Williams was the last survivor to be pulled from the wreckage. Exhausted rescuers nearly drilled him with a jackhammer trying to break apart the slab that pinned him down. After 12 hours, the workers thought they had cleared most of the bodies, but by 7:15 a.m. Saturday morning, they lifted the final slab. Beneath it, 31 more people lay crushed to death. Fatally injured victims were given morphine to ease their pain, and rescuers at times were required to dismember bodies to reach other victims. The footage of the hours following the collapse were especially disturbing, as the spokesman for the police department explained that they've utilized every hospital in the area and all they know is that the death toll is going to rise. The Kansas City mayor was on the scene and said that he'd been to the makeshift morgue and they were trying to identify the deceased using wallets, fingerprints, everything they could. Joe Wakerl claimed that when he walked in, every one of your senses was assaulted. The smell was characteristic of what you would expect at a scene of carnage. There were wires swinging above everyone, the smell of gas and fuel. Just getting the debris moved to get to victims proved incredibly difficult. Some survivors needed their limbs amputated so they could be extracted from the rubble. And to make matters worse, damaged sprinkler systems gushed water into the atrium, creating the very real possibility that trapped victims would be drowned if they weren't rescued in time. Plus, since the sprinkler system was supplied from tanks rather than city supplies, it wasn't possible to turn them off. The hotel's front doors were acting as a dam for flooding the atrium floor, so Kansas City's fire chief ordered a bulldozer to break the doors and connect the broken pipes with fire hose to prevent further flooding. In all, 114 people died from the walkway collapse and more than 200 were injured. Thousands of family members were left with pain, grief, depression, anger, and Kansas City itself was plunged into despair. At first, no one knew who was to blame. Pat Foley, president of the Hyatt hotel chain, stated 2 days after the collapse that the catwalks were designed to hold people shoulder to shoulder, as many as you can jam in there, whereas witnesses say they saw the walkways swaying and bouncing with people's movement. It was, clearly, the design of the walkways that was to blame. So, what caused this horrific tragedy? We know it was the walkways, but why? 3 days after the disaster, Wayne G. Lischka, a structural engineer, began conducting an investigation as to how this exactly happened. He discovered that the rod designs specifically were to blame. The walkways of the Hyatt were meant to be suspended on continuous rods. At some point, this had been changed. According to my source, the manufacturer of these rods had concerns at the time. In their opinion, the need for the tie rods to be threaded along their entire length meant they could easily be damaged during walkway hoisting, ultimately rendering them useless. They changed the design to include two sets of tie rods to be used instead of the intended continuous ones. One set was used to connect the fourth floor to the atrium roof. The other attached the second floor walkway to the fourth floor walkway. This design was to prove fatal. This required the fourth floor beams to support both weight of the fourth floor walkway and also the underlying second floor walkway. As it turned out, recipe for disaster. That night, the stress became too great. The box beams split along welds and the nuts supporting them slipped through the gap. There's a few diagrams online that show the difference between these hanger rods and tie rods, and those will obviously be in my sources if you want to take a closer look. There's also a fantastic demonstration of what this looks like in YouTuber Tom Scott's video featuring Grady from Practical Engineering. The point is simply that rather than the fourth and second floor walkways being supported by a continuous rod, the second floor walkway was being supported by the fourth floor walkway above and the weight was simply too much. Even though this design change looks somewhat minimal to the untrained eye, the engineers that approved this should have calculated the difference. Yet, lack of communication and poor or no calculations and just general negligence all contributed to this collapse. One source claims that, unbelievably at times, design changes were confirmed over the phone rather than checking the documentation or calculations. So naturally, fingers were pointed everywhere. Architects had wanted the skywalks to look airy with thin support rods. The steel fabricator sketched a revised plan that never went through official channels of review. Crown Center Redevelopment Corporation, a wholly owned subsidiary of Hallmark Cards, Inc., became the target of lawsuits. Yet, even the original design was far from perfect. One source states that according to Wayne's investigation, it would have only met 60% of the city's prescribed building code requirements. As for the simple, disappointing answer as to how this could have happened in the first place, people got sloppy. Even though investigators could easily point out the structural trigger that led to this event, the architects and designers simply did not care enough to prevent this. Everyone made assumptions that someone else had done the calculations. A worker who covered the walkways with drywall before the hotel even opened noticed a box beam bending, but thought nothing of it. Responsibility was avoided at every turn, making this case all the more rage-inducing. The NIST, or the National Institute of Standards and Tech, published the investigation into the collapse. It is 378 pages long, and the point that they make is that basic tests should have been done and were not done, and it undeniably proved that this walkway was doomed to fail, and that it was so easily avoidable. Even Jack D. Gillum of Jack D. Gillum & Associates, the architects that took on this project, later admitted that it was so obviously flawed, any first-year engineering student could figure it out. Other sources explain that another contributing factor is that the walkways were, relatively speaking, a minor part of the project. After all, this hotel was huge, with a revolving restaurant on top of the tower. Given how complex it was, these hallways were a small part of the project. This is why even seemingly small design changes still need to go through proper processes, reviews, and tests. People were justifiably outraged the more they learned. Those survivors and their families didn't get answers until February 1982. Once they did, it was clear that those who approved these design changes, simply for the sake of saving time and money, needed to be held accountable. In February 1984, 2 years later, the Missouri Board of Architects, Professional Engineers, and Land Surveyors filed a complaint against Daniel M. Duncan, a structural engineer at the Jack D. Gillum firm who prepared and supervised the preparation of the structure's drawings. The complaint was also filed against Jack D. Gillum himself, as well as GCE International Incorporated, and charged the three with gross negligence, incompetence, misconduct, and unprofessional conduct in the practice of engineering. All three were found guilty, and subsequently, Duncan and Gillum lost their licenses to practice engineering in the state of Missouri. GCE had its certificate of authority as an engineering firm revoked. Hyatt, a name that had been unstoppable, profitable, and seemingly untainted, was now making headlines for the 100-plus people that passed away in their lobby. Some engineers and firms went bankrupt after this, and while Hyatt survived, there's no doubt this became a chapter in their company history that they'd rather forget, considering the articles about them and their own company history fails to mention it. I will say that Gillum, at the very least, has held himself accountable and doesn't seem to have tried to blame others for his negligence. He said in interviews that the buck stops with me. This was my engineering seal on the plans. He also occasionally speaks to professional conferences because his mission is to, quote, scare the daylights out of them. Engineering societies need to talk about failures. That's how we learn, end quote. And I do agree with him here, that we shouldn't turn away from this disaster or pretend like it never can happen again. Believing we're invincible or unlikely to make the same mistake again is ignorance. Even a superficial look into history alone will tell us as much. Frankly, I agree with his mindset far more, and Duncan's own lawyer, Lawrence B. Gabriel, who claimed to be shocked and dismayed when the two lost their licenses. Which, quite frankly, should not be shocking considering what happened here. Gillum did put his seal on the plans. He is responsible for said plans, period. I understand this lawyer was just doing his job, but you gotta remember that people died here and you need to be accountable for that. Of course, as far as the families and friends that lost loved ones, I'm sure this brought little comfort. Civil lawsuits were filed and over $140 million were awarded to victims and their families. A large amount of this money was from Crown Center Corporation. According to a New York Times article released around this time, the agreement also calls for Hallmark Cards to pay $6.5 million over the next 4 years to seven of the city's charities. The contributions were explained in an agreement as a healing gesture to help Kansas City put the tragedy of the Skywalk's collapse behind it. Recipients of those funds include the Heart of America United Way, the Truman Medical Foundation, and the Children's Mercy Hospital. Judge Wright called the settlement unprecedented, adding that the fact the case was settled was almost a wonder in itself. There were quite a few lawsuits filed around this time, and not just from civilians. There were also rescuer claims made, such as one from fireman Moen L. Phillips, who alleged he suffered physical and emotional damages as a result of his rescue work in the hotel after the Skywalk's collapse. Hallmark, the owner of the Crown Center Corporation, tried to dismiss Phillips' complaint on the grounds that it was barred by the fireman's rule. And the fireman's rule, if you have never heard of it, is this. An old common law doctrine that bars injured public safety responders from maintaining a negligence action against a tortfeasor whose alleged malfeasance is responsible for bringing the officer to the scene of a fire, crime, or other emergency where the officer is injured. Most states have a fireman's rule in place, and that does include Missouri. Simply put, it's a way of saying you can't bring a lawsuit against the company where you arrive to rescue people since it's part of your job. And I understand that that is very much an oversimplification, but that is the gist of it. At first, this worked and the motion was dismissed, but in April 1986, the decision was reversed. After all, freak accidents do happen, but rescuers weren't just in danger because the walkways collapsed, but because of the poor construction and negligence itself. However, once 79 similar cases on behalf of over 150 people were brought forward, the Missouri Supreme Court unanimously reinstated the judgment of dismissal. Rescuer claims were barred again. However, other rescuer suits still proceeded under the banner of class action. On December 17, 1987, AP News wrote, U.S. District Judge D. Brooke Bartlett gave final approval Tuesday to the settlement of the lawsuit and to the class, which included 190 responders, their spouses, and others who suffered injuries directly related to the collapse of the Skywalks and rescue operations. Approval of the settlement will end 6 years' litigation over liability for damages and responsibility for the disaster of July 17, 1981, during a hotel tea dance. And 6 years has got to be an incredibly frustrating time to wait, especially in a case that you would think is so incredibly straightforward. After all, we've talked about how obviously negligent those responsible here were, yet it took 6 years for some families to settle these cases. And for the record, I know it's not all about money here, and I'm sure all of them would have rather had their family members back. But it's disappointing that many had to wait this long for any sense of closure. Yet another aspect of these lawsuits was somewhat unexpected, and it was the fact that it wasn't just the civilian victims of the walkway collapse filing suits, but the Hyatt Regency Hotel itself. Apparently, they filed a $4 million lawsuit against Haven Steel Corporation, Gillum Colicole Consulting Structural Engineers Incorporated, and Eldridge and Son Construction Co. Incorporated, the general contractor. After all, Hyatt Regency Hotel had trusted their architects, and after such a horrific event occurred at one of their properties, well, their name and reputation were certainly going through the ringer. I wasn't able to find out exactly what happened with this specific set of lawsuits, and sources, just some don't even mention it, but from what I can tell, Haven Steel, Gillum, and every other construction, engineering, and design company that had a role in this could have easily prevented it, and to some extent, was held accountable. As for the fallout, expectedly, it was massive. This walkway collapse essentially became the example of what not to do for engineers, according to one source. Many false theories persist about the cause of this fatal collapse. The failure was not due to poor workmanship, shoddy materials, a rushed schedule, swaying from dancing, harmonic vibrations from the music, poor contractor communication, or design changes that did not receive proper review. As documented in the official investigation report, two professional engineers issued sealed design drawings without performing critical calculations to determine whether sufficient load capacity existed. Casting blame on others is easy and simple. However, focusing responsibility on our own engineering profession teaches us a hard-earned history lesson. Overlooking a small detail, even on a multi-million dollar project, can prove fatal. Few people know or remember that the original design also would have failed, as seen in the deflection of flanges of the box beam on one skywalk that remained. The engineers failed to conduct stress calculations on either design, yet the structural engineer of record, Gillum, applied his professional seals. Although we can't know exactly how and when the original designs might have failed since they were never used, The fact that no stress calculation test was ever done ultimately is the culprit here. I do believe the horrible communication and rushed schedule may have played a role, but had these calculations been done, this entire tragedy could have been avoided. Hence why this has become such an important lesson among engineers. Standards of peer review improved as a result of the Kansas City Codes Administration became its own department. Under the old system, one city engineer may review only electrical drawings, another plumbing, another something else. I think you get the idea. Now, one single engineer is responsible for reviewing all aspects of the building plan to be sure the pieces fit safely together, viewing it as a whole. Architectural engineer Lishka also pointed out that as a result of Hyatt, many developers in Kansas City seem to swear off putting suspended or otherwise dramatic interior features in public buildings. Hotels went simple after that, he said. You look around the lobbies here and nothing's really dramatic. That's kind of sad. The press was also affected. For about 16 months after the collapse, the two newspapers of the Kansas City Star Company, The Star and The Times, published many articles detailing such things as design changes that had weakened the skywalk support systems, a finding verified by the National Bureau of Standards in its investigation. The paper's investigations also found structural failures and defects that arose in the construction of the hotel, lapses in engineering and construction practices, and faults in the city's code enforcement department. Kansas City had been at a turning point, catching its breath from their tremendous progress in the 1970s, so this was a stinging blow to community pride. A lot of people, especially businessmen, seemed to blame the press for spreading this throughout the country. Hallmark itself never really had a bad line of press anywhere before, so to suddenly have to deal with this terrible tragedy and all the implications was incredibly difficult for them. Though Kansas City was obviously affected, the entire nation felt the ripple effects of the disaster. In 1983, the Reagan administration made a move to eliminate an agency of the National Bureau of Standards, but this case argued directly against them, as the branch had been the only one to conduct an impartial investigation. Today, in the Hyatt Regency, where there had been three skywalks in the lobby, there is now one huge one on the second floor, supported by massive pillars rather than suspended by 1 1/4 steel rods. In the collapse, such rods pulled through steel box beams supporting the walkways. Some $5 million has been spent to reconstruct the hotel, and local authorities say that has made the building possibly the safest in the country. As of 2011, however, the hotel has since become the Sheraton Kansas City Hotel at Crown Center. What had once been Missouri's tallest building from 1980 to 1986 is now more known for being an example of what not to do to engineers across the country. It wasn't until 2009, decades later, that Hallmark donated $25,000 to a memorial fund for victims and rescue workers. Hyatt didn't contribute since the location became a Sheraton. It was a Hyatt at the time, so I don't see why that should have stopped them, but apparently that's their reasoning. Sheraton, in fact, donated $5,000. And so 34 years later, in 2015, the Skywalk Memorial finally became a reality. This was the moment in history that wrenched innocent loved ones from our arms and not our hearts, survivor Frank Freeman said at the dedication of a memorial for those who died, those who survived, those who helped, and those who lost loved ones. Mothers, fathers, children, grandparents, sisters, brothers, friends, spouses, and lovers, all were gone in an instant. Gone. Just gone. How could that be? The names of the victims are etched in the memorial, the centerpiece of which is a 20-foot abstract sculpture of a couple embraced in dance. The disaster happened during a big band dance contest. They gathered there for a Friday night tea dance, said Brent Wright, who lost his mother and stepfather, Karen and Eugene Jeter. They were looking forward to a night of music, dancing, fun with family and friends. And instead, that night turned into disaster and tragedy. 25 years later, a small group of people sat down and began to discuss the possibility of a memorial to the events of that night. Today, with patience, faith, determination, and your help, we've made that possibility a reality. The memorial site at 22nd Street and Gilham Road is in the shadow of the former Hyatt Regency, now a Sheraton Hotel. Frank Freeman lost his partner, Roger Grisby, at the Hyatt. John Sullivan lost his parents. It took more than 300 donors and 10 years to raise $550,000 for the memorial and a maintenance endowment. Looking back at the news footage at the time, the interviews of those that went through this traumatic event, it's important to remember how such a simple mistake can truly affect the lives of those for years to come. Frank Freeman, the president of the Memorial Foundation that organized the memorial, stated, "You don't forget it. It will always be with you. But as far as the healing process, this will help many, many people. It won't close the book, but it'll help." And with all of that being said, that's where I'm going to end today's kind of somber prism of the past. I think this is an important event to look at to understand why technology changes, why we change the way we look at things, the way we build things, and that this is an example, an unfortunate shining moment of why these changes have to constantly be made and we revamp and redo things. And if we forget, we're doomed to repeat it. So I think it's important to learn about this event, learn why this is significant, and learn, obviously, so we don't have this happen again. I want to thank you for spending some of your time here with me today. I hope you learned something new. If you did, make sure that you are following so that you can always stay up to date on the latest episodes. I want to thank you for being here today, and I'll see you in the next one. Bye.